So we're going to start with, okay, Peter. So I want to use a Keylerian K3 surface, which means that I'm focusing on the complex structure for the time being, and we'll get to a choice of Kähler metric a little bit later. I want to choose an isomorphism between H2XZ and an abstract integer quadratic form of signature 319, which I explained, I think in the first lecture, is isomorphic to two copies of what's called the hyperbolic plane, three copies of what's called the hyperbolic plane. Plus two copies of what's called the E8 lattice, but with its sign changed. Anyway, there's some well-defined abstract integral quadratic form on a lattice of rank 22. And the fact that I've got a Keylerian K3 surface means I've chosen a complex structure. So X determines a subspace, H20 of X, spanned by this is in the complex cohomology, spanned by the holomorphic 2 form. So this is C times the holomorphic 2 form. And if you look at the orthogonal complement of the holomorphic 2 form in H2 of X, that's equal to what's called the orthogonal complement of both the holomorphic 2 form and its complex conjugate. That's called H11 of X with complex coefficients. And if you want H11 X with real coefficients, which is also a sensible thing, that's just the orthogonal complement of the real part of omega and the imaginary part of omega in H2X real. So I'm going to state a bunch of facts. So fact one is that if you take the real 1-1 classes and you intersect with the integer classes, that's the Picard lattice of X, i.e., for all alpha in that intersection, alpha is the first Chern class of a line bundle. I'm also going to represent line bundles by divisors, so there's a correspondence between line bundles and divisors, so I might also call that the first Chern class of O of D, and other similar notation is to say that alpha is the cohomology class of D in square brackets. So those are all sort of equivalent notions. Okay, a list of facts, let me make sure I get them in the right order. So fact two, and this is the Riemann-Roch theorem, in this case. Fact two says if you look at the Euler characteristic of O of D, that's the same thing as the Euler characteristic of the structure sheaf, plus, this is true for arbitrary algebraic surfaces, D squared minus k dot d divided by 2. So k is the canonical class, but it's trivial in cohomology because I have a K3 surface. So this statement is true for all surfaces, and for a K3 surface, it's just 2 plus d squared over 2. So this chi of O means h naught of O minus h1 of O, the lowercase means dimension, plus h2 of O. Right, h naught of O is always 1. H2 of O is the same thing as the dimension of H02, and that's by one of the symmetries, H20, and we know that's 1. And H1 of O, that's the same as H01, which is H10. That's the number of 1 forms, and on a K3 surface, that's 0. So the holomorphic Euler characteristic, chi of O, is 1 minus 0 plus 1 equals 2, and then there's no contribution from the K dot D term. And while I sort of have it here, Let me also mention the genus formula. So fact three, if C is an irreducible curve, irreducible algebraic curve. All right, so I think I've done this once or twice before, but let me do it again. It's called a K3 surface. It's a two-dimensional complex manifold or algebraic variety, but its underlying space is a four-manifold. And this is called an algebraic curve, which is a Riemann surface. Okay, so the dimensions being referred to are complex dimensions. If C is an irreducible algebraic curve, then the canonical divisor on C is given by what's called the adjunction formula. It's Kx plus C intersected with C. Kx is trivial, so that's C intersected with C. And this, of course, is 2g minus 2 for the genus of the curve. So that relates the self-intersection of a curve, this is what was called C squared up here, relates the self-intersection of a curve to the genus. And it tells you that in the case of an irreducible curve, chi of O of C is, this is 2g minus 2 divided by 2, that's g minus 1 plus 2 is g plus 1. Okay. So now from this, and I also want to point out fact four. Again, C irreducible implies, well, I'm going to give the argument for this, but it implies that H1 of O of C is equal to 0. So this is a sort of nice argument. There's an exact sequence of which goes like this. You take Ox of minus C, mapping into Ox, and restrict to C. So this is local functions on X, the sheaf of functions on X, restricted to functions on C, and the kernel is functions which vanish on C. That's what Ox of minus C means. And now you look at the long exact sequence in cohomology. So you get a one-dimensional space of global functions on X, since it's a compact surface. That restricts to the one-dimensional space of global functions on the curve, because it's an irreducible curve. So this part would not have been true if it were not irreducible. So you go around here, and you have H1 of Ox of minus C. And because this was an isomorphism, this actually has to be an injection into H1 of Ox. But as I already mentioned, H1 of O of X is 0. So this injects into here, and that implies H1 of OX of minus C is equal to 0. Oh, and I should have mentioned, this probably should have been fact 3.5, what seriduality tells you for K3s. So seriduality generally would have said that HI of O of L was the same as H2 minus I of O of K minus L, dual. But of course, K is trivial, so that's H2 minus I of O of minus L. And the dual vector space is it's canonically a dual vector space. Obviously, the dimensions will be the same. So, should have said that first, because now, from my little calculation here, I conclude that H1 of Ox of minus C is the same as H1 of Ox of C. So H1 of Ox of C also has to be 0. Okay. And let's see. One or two more. So if I write out what the Riemann-Roch theorem says, it says H0 of O of D minus H1 of O of D plus H2 of O of D, but that's H0 of O of minus D, is equal to 2 plus D squared over 2. So I'm back to the case of an arbitrary divisor, not necessarily an irreducible algebraic curve. And what that implies is that H naught of, sorry, what that implies is if d squared is at least minus 2, then h naught of O of D plus h naught of O of minus D is strictly greater than 0. That implies either D or minus D is effective. The only way that you could have an effective divisor whose negative is also an effective divisor is if the divisor is 0. So if D is not equal to the 0 divisor, then only 1 of D and minus D is effective. And if you write it in terms of irreducible components and so on, once you get down to an irreducible component, the previous argument tells you that there really wasn't an H1 term, and that the this fact 3, so if C is irreducible, then what I really conclude here is H0 of O of C is the same as chi of O of C, which is G plus 1. Okay, so that's some sort of basic things about curves on a K3 surface. And it shows that the most critical information about the curve, well, first of all, we kind of need to know which are the irreducible curves. But all divisors have this property that once their self-intersection is sufficiently big, they'll be effective. If you have an effective irreducible divisor, it can have self-intersection at most, it has self-intersection greater than or equal to minus 2. From that, we can sort of assemble a picture of what all of the effective divisors look like. So inside of H2 of XZ, I can put the set of all classes D such that D is an effective divisor. And I'll just abbreviate that by saying H0 of O of D is greater than 0. What's not completely obvious is that this is contained in the set of all alpha in H2XZ. They have to be type 1-1, of course, but it's a set of all alpha in H2 of XZ such that alpha squared is greater than or equal to minus 2. So it's not completely obvious that you can't that's false, so let me just erase it. Never mind. So inside here, I can take the set of all set of all irreducible classes, and it's irreducible effective, so this is slightly redundant, and this guy is a subset of the set of alphas whose square is greater than or equal to minus 2. Now, what I explained last time was this global Torelli theorem, which said that if you know the Kähler cone, which is the dual of this information here, so I should point out that omega in H2XR is Kähler, if and only if the intersection of omega with C is strictly positive for all C in I'm going to call this, as I did before, pickaxe. Neuron severity is probably a better name, but they're the same in this case. For all C, this is not pickaxe. This is effective divisors. So this is the cone of effective divisors. So for all C in the cone of effective divisors, I have to have a positive intersection number. And because of that, knowing the collection of effective divisors is equivalent to knowing the Kähler cone. So if you remember, we had to have, if you had two isomorphisms like this, which preserved the H20 part, or equivalently the H11 part, remember I had H11XR inside of H1XR, and the Kähler cone, so that means knowing which lattice I have for the Picard lattice, together with knowing what the classes of effective curves are in that Picard lattice, if I had two things which preserved that information, then there was an isomorphism between the corresponding K3s. And what I think I didn't state was the surjectivity of the period map, which says if you have data of that kind, an appropriate cone in... I might have stated surjectivity, I don't remember. An appropriate cone in H11 together with this Hodge decomposition information, then there is a K3 surface with that particular complex structure. So I basically translated the question into questions about the existence of certain kinds of cones, which are the divisor classes of effective curves. We'll have to have a little bit more refined information about when you get effective curves here. So I want the cones which are associated to effective curves. And then there is some additional question. If you have that Picard lattice and you take its orthogonal complement, so I should point out that PicX perp sitting inside of H, say, 2XR, that's some space of some dimension, and I have to fit my H20 into the complexification of that space. So it constrains where the Hodge structure can go, and if you make dimension counts of how many complex parameters we've specified, essentially each rank of a Picard group cuts down the number of parameters by one. So generally speaking, if the Picard group is trivial, then I find 20 complex parameters for the corresponding complex K3 surfaces. Or more generally, if the rank of the Picard group is rho, then I find 20 minus rho complex parameters. And that's just a matter of where you get to put the H20 subspace inside of the corresponding H2X, the complexification H2XC, and the orthogonal complement of the Picard group in there. So anyway, this the global trilogy and surjectivity of the period map allow you to translate lots of interesting geometric questions, particularly ones that can be phrased in terms of existence of divisors of various kinds, into basically questions about when can I find an appropriate cone and how of effective divisors, and how can I embed that into this abstract K3 lattice. So I've been working here, but now if I map it into lambda 319, I can look for this structure a little more abstractly inside lambda 319, and anytime I find this structure, I get a natural family of K3 surfaces, which are the ones whose H20 is constrained to be in the orthogonal complement of the structure that I've written down. So any question about where I'm going or what I'm sort of doing in general? Okay. So rational curves. So irreducible rational curves, we just saw, are classes whose self-intersection is minus 2. And you can ask, what are other rational curves like? So the claim is so let me choose a class D such that D squared is positive. And look at the set of C such that D dot C is equal to 0, and C is effective. Well, I should have pointed out that the metric that we're talking about, the quadratic integral quadratic form that we're talking about on the Picard group, has signature 1, comma, rho minus 1. There's one positive eigenvalue and rho minus 1 negative eigenvalues, except in the very special case that what I chose was one class of self-intersection 0. So then I would have signature. Oh, sorry. I could always do that. Sorry. So it. Shoot. Okay. So there are three cases. Rats. I'm not in the algebraic situation. So there are three cases. The Picard group of X has signature 1 row minus 1. The Picard group of X has signature, okay, the notation for this is not ideal. It has a 0 eigenvalue. And so there's 1 0 eigenvalue. If I'm using this notation, I probably should have put in a 0 already up here, but anyway, never mind, I didn't do it. And then the third possibility is that it's negative definite, so it's 0 row. But anyway, the point is that the ambient space, the H11 space, has only one positive eigenvalue. And that means if I've chosen a D whose self-intersection is positive, and the very existence of such a D only happens in case one, if I've chosen such a D and I look at the classes, the Cs, which are effective and have intersection number 0 with D, that is negative definite. And generally, you could ask questions about a collection of effective curves which had a negative definite lattice. So I want to spend a few minutes investigating those negative definite lattices. So maybe I have some generating set C1 to CK. Let these generate the lattice. Maybe this is going to be called L. And so what we know is that CI squared is minus 2. CI dot CJ is greater than or equal to 0 if I is not equal to J. So I kind of want to proceed from this information using, again, the fact that the lattice is negative definite. So I'm going to do a classification of these. And I'll tell you the answer before I start. The answer is ADE. Okay, so how does this classification go? So first of all, if ci dot cj is greater than or equal to 2 for any I and j, then when you calculate ci plus cj squared, right, I get minus 2 plus 2 ci cj minus 2, and that's greater than or equal to 0. In my classification, I can eliminate the possibility of there being a positive linear combination of my generating classes, which has non-negative self-intersection, because I'm supposed to have a negative definite lattice. So the key property I'm using is the negative definiteness. So that's a contradiction. So two distinct curves, this is I not equal to J. Two distinct curves can meet in at most one point. So now I'm going to draw a bunch of pictures, and all of my pictures are pictures of configurations which have self-intersection 0. And if I find a subgraph of my graph, okay, so I have to make a graph out of this. What I'm going to do is represent the curves by lines. I mean, they're rational curves, so if it were over the reals, they would look like lines. And then represent intersections by things crossing, CI meeting CJ. And that gives you the complete combinatorial data because it tells you who meets who and so on. So if I write down a bunch of graphs which support something of self-intersection 0, and the way I'll show that it supports them is I am going to list, I'm not going to name the curves, but I'm going to list the multiplicity in the linear combination which has self-intersection 0. If I find such a graph with self-intersection 0, then I know that not only can that graph not occur, it could never be a subgraph of my overall diagram. Because if it's a subgraph, I could just take that subset of curves, I would find a class of self-intersection greater than or equal to zero supported there, actually equal to zero supported there, and that would tell me that I didn't have a negative definite lattice. So I'm quickly classifying for you these negative definite lattices with the property that the diagonal elements are all minus twos and the off-diagonal elements are all non-negative. And so here's my list of things that support something of self-intersection zero. So I can have a polygon of any length, and I'm putting multiplicity one on each side. And so this one I'll do is C0 up to Cn minus 1, and if I intersect it with any of the Ci's, well, I get 1 for the neighbor on the left, minus 2 for the self-intersection, plus 1 for the neighbor on the right, which gives me 0. So in particular, if I intersect it with the sum of all the Ci's, I get 0. My second graph, well, it has a special case, which is a curve meeting four other curves. But the general case is like this. So I have a whole bunch of twos, and then dot, 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 two, and then ones on the end. And so again, you can verify for yourself. Maybe I'll sort of do it mentally this time. I'm taking the linear combination with the coefficients that are specified, and I'm checking that its intersection with each individual component is zero. So for example, here, I have 1 plus 1 plus 2, 4 neighboring intersections, but minus 2 times 2, negative 4 of the self-intersection. And you can go all the way along this graph and verify that that continues to hold, that the combination that I've written down intersected with each of the curves Ci is itself zero. The next one looks like this. 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, 2, 1. Next one looks like this. 4, 2, 3, 2, 1. And then 3, 2, 1 on this side. And the next one looks like this. 6, 3, 4, 2, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay. So there are a bunch of graph configurations which have, you can verify for yourself that it always has the property that I mentioned. Another way of saying the property is that the multiplicity on a given curve is one half of the sum of the multiplicities adjoining the curve. So again, 1 plus 1 plus 2 is 4, that's twice 2. Twice 2 is 2 plus 2, and so on for these things. And here I can do, you know, twice 4 is 6 plus 2, and twice 6 is 4 plus 3 plus 5, and so on. Right? So those are okay. And now it's a very simple exercise to write down all graphs of this kind. So they never meet in more than a single point, right? And I should say that I am not distinguishing between this and this. I don't have to distinguish between them because never mind. Those are not among my graphs. So actually, there's no ambiguity. It will all be single point crossings at a time. And so the solutions of all the graphs that you can get this way are AN, where you have N components, DN, where you have one of these double N's, but not the other one. Technically, I just removed one of the curves. So the last one, if I were thinking of these numbers, the last one would have a 1 with 2's in the middle. And then I have E6, which is this guy with one of the curves removed. E7, which is this guy with, again, one of the curves removed. And E8, which is this guy. And by the way, I'm removing a curve of multiplicity 1 in every case, and that's another sort of way to remember. Actually, here I didn't do it right. Let's try that one again. Oh, no, I did it right. Sorry. Okay. So this is the complete list of graphs, and sorry, there are n curves here as well. curves. That's the labeling. And if you count, there are 6, 7, and 8 curves in these three cases. Okay, so just starting from that very simple hypothesis, I ended up with these graphs. They have another interesting property, which is that there is a reflection group associated to any such guy. Oh, sorry. That's a complete list of connected guys. So I could have disconnected ones where I had combinations of those, but that's a complete list of connected. I forgot what I was just about to say. Oh, reflection groups. So there are reflection groups associated with these guys. And it goes like this. If C is an irreducible rational curve, then there's a map which takes D to D plus the intersection number of D with C times C. And that map has the property that it preserves, it's a reflection, and it preserves inner products. So inner products are preserved. C itself is going to go to C plus minus 2 times C, which is minus C. So if I started out with an effective curve, I would end up with the anti-effective curve, or vice versa. And what happens to D, so if D dot C, for example, is equal to 1, then D will go to a sort of bigger curve. And D plus C will have to have, actually this is an easy calculation, D plus C will have to have the same intersection, self-intersection as D. So if I apply this to various Ds, where D squared is minus 2 already, then I find other classes of self-intersection minus 2 by adding them. Or if D dot C is negative 1, all right, so that wouldn't happen if D were effective already. And in fact, in that case, D will go to D minus C. It could happen if D were effective, but it wouldn't happen if D were irreducible. So I could have an effective curve meeting C with intersection number negative 1, and then this reflection property would have just subtracted C as a component from D. So if D had been effective, this is still going to be an effective curve. So you can either add these minus 2 curves or subtract minus 2 curves from various composites of plus and minus curves, and you end up discovering that the entire collection of Ds in this lattice L with the property that its self-intersection is minus 2 splits, so let me call that R, splits into two halves, R plus union R minus, where these are the effective ones, D dot C greater than 0. Sorry, I need to assume right now that C is a connected diagram. So if C is a connected, if L, whatever it was called, consists of a connected collection of irreducible rational curves, then you can sort of sort them according to whether their intersection with C is positive or negative. So these are going to be the effective ones. And as we saw, plus or minus things have to be effective, so these are minus effective ones. But if you reflect in C, then you shuffle around which ones are effective and which ones are minus effective. In fact, C itself goes from an effective curve to a minus effective curve, and then there will be a corresponding shift in all the others where you add C to some things, subtract C from other things, change the list of what's effective and what's minus effective. So this reflection group structure is called a Coxeter group. All right, I don't really have time to go into all the nice combinatorics, this is another approach to classifying the corresponding lattices, is to try to figure out what kinds of reflections are possible, which corresponding reflections would make sense, and you end up with this list of reflection groups. There's another piece of mathematics where the same combinatorics shows up, which I mentioned last time, which is the classification of semi-simple Lie algebras, and they're classified by Dicken diagrams, and some of those Dicken diagrams are so-called simply laced, which, if you know the Lie theory, means that the Cartan matrix is symmetric. And so these are, in that case, these are the associated Weyl groups of the corresponding Lie group or algebra. So anyway, I've got this nice connection between some of the Lie theory and some of the combinatorial things that happen in the Lie theory and the collection of curves. Now, a decomposition like this is a choice in Lie theory of what are called positive roots. And once I've made a choice of positive roots, I know which ones are, I mean, the positive roots are the corresponding to effective curves. And that is the set of positive roots lie in one fundamental domain for this, the action of this reflection group on the on this space of possible classes, this space that I'm calling R, actually I was calling it L a few minutes ago, but on the real vector space spanned by L, I have some kind of fundamental domain. And if I wanted to get to a different fundamental domain, all I would need to do would be to apply this reflection. So I could have a reflection in the class C, and that would, it's going to do nothing along here, which is C perp, but that would change me from one fundamental domain to a different fundamental domain for the same group action. So that was actually the last step in getting control over the surjectivity of the period map, so I should mention that. If I had, if I were trying to understand surjectivity of the period map in the sort of generalized context where I had omega, which is almost Kähler, in the sense that omega squared is positive, and omega lies in the closure of the set of Kähler classes, then there's a sort of little issue about possible isomorphisms from XR, from XZ into lambda, and what happens to omega with these guys. And omega is going to go to some phi of omega, which almost is guaranteed to lie in the Kähler cone, in the closure of the Kähler cone, but not quite. So this turns out to be in the closure of a given positive cone. Union, it translates by the reflection group of the lattice omega perf. So it may be that if I had a chosen isomorphism between H2XZ and lambda 319, I can almost make omega go to something in the closure of the Kähler cone, and I can definitely do it after, if I modify which fundamental domain of this action I'm looking at. So that's not a real big change, and it's pretty easy to accommodate. Okay, so, and as I've sort of mentioned, what happens if you look at omega, omega naturally corresponds to a something like a Kähler class on an orbifold X bar, which is the result of blowing down all these curves CI such that omega intersected with CI is equal to zero. And once I've done that, I don't have the possibility of moving around in that complementary space anymore, so this choice is not completely relevant, but you need the choice to get going. Okay, so this is how we get to these so-called ADE singularities. There's another side to this story which is very pretty, which is that these results of blowing down, so you get complex singularities from blowing down these diagrams of a special type, and the complex singularities that you get all have the form C2 mod gamma, where gamma is a finite subgroup of SL2C, and then those groups turn out to have the same ADE classification. AN is a cyclic group of order N plus 1. DN, AN corresponds to the cyclic group. DN corresponds to something called a binary dihedral group. And N minus 3 times 2. Okay. It's a binary dihedral group of order 2N minus, binary dihedral, 4N minus 3. Oh boy, dn 2n, d4 is b8, but I have to make it go by multiples of 8, so maybe I mean 8n, some function here, which I forgot to look up. And so why binary? There, of course, this is all going to go into the maximal compact subgroup SU2. And SU2 is a double cover of SO3, and we're more familiar with the images in SO3, right, because those are rotation groups, but there's a plus or minus center in SU2, and so you have to extend the rotation groups by a plus or minus center. You don't have to do that for the cyclic case, but for other cases you do, which is what makes it binary. And D here is Cartan's D, and D here is dihedral. Okay, sorry. And then there are E67 and E8, which correspond, as I said briefly last time, my props are gone, which correspond to the binary tetrahedral, the binary octahedral, and the binary icosahedral groups. So the corresponding rotation groups are the symmetries of the platonic solids. Anyway, it's this sort of remarkable fact that if you take C2 modulo one of these groups and then resolve the singularities minimally, you will end up with a configuration of minus two curves, which has the graph, the corresponding graph that I drew.
Yeah? So you have like a reflection for each rational curve on your K3
yes.
surface?
Yes. So if I had a... So right now I'm only looking at the reflections for the rational curves in the complement of some class of self-intersection, positive self-intersection. But in general, I could look at a much bigger reflection group potentially, where you had all the rational curves and they gave you this big reflection group inside of the hyperbolic lattice with signature 1, comma, rho minus 1. And there are a lot of interesting things about that story, but I'm not telling them today. So let me tell you about the work of Professor Kummer from the middle of the 19th century. So Kummer, I think, is best known in mathematics for his work on number theory, but he also did some work on geometry. And he asked the following question. For which k do there exist a... quartic surface in P3, which has precisely k ordinary double points. And ordinary double point is another name for an A1 singularity. So this corresponds to C2 mod Z2. The action of Z2 on C2 is taking xy to minus x minus y. Sorry, maybe I'll call it uv to minus u minus v. And then this one's real easy. The invariants are u squared, uv, and v squared, which I might call x, y, and z. And then there's an obvious relation, y squared equals xz. So that's the local equation in three complex variables for the corresponding singularity. And that's a quadratic equation of maximal rank in three complex variables, and that is often called an ordinary double point. And it turns out not to matter. The higher order terms don't matter. You still get this kind of A1 singularity. Now, if you, let me call this one X bar. Now, if you resolve singularities of X bar, what you'll have is a collection of disjoint rational curves. So a minute ago, I was interested in the whole classification with the ADE and so on, but now I'm talking about disjoint ones. So CICJ is going to be minus 2 delta IJ. So I'll have a collection of disjoint rational curves, and in addition, I'll have a divisor D, which is the pullback of the hyperplane class, O of 1, on the projective space. And it will have the property that its self-intersection is 4, and its intersection with each CI is equal to 0. So I'm in the same situation that I put myself in a few minutes ago, where I was classifying negative definite lattices. This is a particularly simple negative definite lattice because it's got a diagonal form with a whole bunch of minus 2s. Okay, so here is some. First, I'm going to derive the wrong answer to this problem, and then we'll see how to correct it. This is not how Mr. Coomer did it. And in fact, I'm going to do a slightly different problem where I don't insist that it's a quartic. So I'm basically just going to look at a disjoint collection of rational curves on a K3 and ask when can I actually find a K3 with that disjoint collection of rational curves. And there's the additional slight complication of putting in the D, which I'm not going to have time to do today. So I won't. I'll just do the Cs. So here's what I want to do. I want to take the integer span of these classes, C1 through CK. And I want to think of that as being mapped by my marking of the cohomology into the lambda 319 lattice. And it's got, so maybe this one is called L. So I take L, phi of L to be, maybe the image is called L. Maybe phi of the span of these guys is L, sitting inside of lambda 319. So the rank of L is K, and the rank of the complement of L is 22 minus K.
So we're already assuming that we're not going to get k bigger than 22.
K certainly is not bigger than 22. So that's observation number one. K, these guys have to be linearly independent. Their homology classes have a non-degenerate matrix like this. So they're definitely linearly independent. And certainly because then they have to go into a rank 22 lattice, there are at most 22 of them. In fact, I have a negative definite intersection matrix, and there it is. The negative signature on this lattice is 19, so I can conclude k less than or equal to 19 immediately. But I want to do something else, and that is maybe I need to set this up. So let me take an m sitting inside of lambda 319, and I want to calculate I want to take m plus m perp inside of lambda 319. And I want to compare these two guys. So this is a unimodular lattice. The determinant of the intersection matrix is 1. But this is not a unimodular lattice. It really can't be a unimodular lattice. For example, if I had 0, 1, 1, 0, I could find in there a class of self-intersection 2, no problem. And its orthogonal complement would be a class of self-intersection minus 2, but the sum of those would have determinant minus 4, whereas this has determinant minus 1. And the solution to that is that there have to be rational combinations of these basis elements, which are actually integer valued in here. So there's this beautiful theory of what's called Nikulin's discriminant form, which helps you address problems like this. And what Nikulin's discriminant form essentially tells you is that you can find a well-defined rational quadratic, sorry, a well-defined quadratic form taking values in Q mod Z on the dual of the lattice mod the lattice. So the M sharp means POM M to Z. And using the fact that I have a non-degenerate bilinear form on M, I can actually embed that in a natural way in M tensor Q. And when I do that, the things which came as adjoints of elements of M, intersections with elements of M, turn out to be integer valued here. And so I end up with the quadratic form naturally taking values in Q mod Z. I'm rushing this slightly, but I don't have a lot of time.
Is L M?
Pardon? Yeah, well, I switched from L to M. So essentially, what Nicolin's theory tells you, with one small technical thing, which I'm suppressing right this moment unfairly, what Nicolin's thing tells you is that if you look at these two, if you look at these two quadratic forms, they have to agree as quadratic forms. The groups have to agree as groups, and the quadratic forms have to agree as quadratic forms up to sine. So Q has to be minus Q perp. And it's that what we're doing is we're creating this element by taking the sum of these two elements and then dividing by 2. And, of course, if you did that, you would get the corresponding element over here, the thing of self-intersection 0. So you need the groups to be the same and the quadratic forms to be the same up to sine whenever you have this. And the thing that I'm assuming, provided that lambda 319 mod m is torsion-free. So if there's torsion in this, there's another version of the story, and we're going to get to that in just a minute. So this is the basic basic tool, and in fact, what Nicolin does is gives a lot of criteria for whether you can embed a given lattice N into the lambda 19 lattice, or any even unimodular lattice, of indefinite signature. He gives criteria for embedding based on properties of these groups. So I want to do a very simple form of that to kind of address Coomer's work in very modern form. Coomer sort of got down and dirty with quartic equations. That's how he did it. But we could do it a different way. And that is to observe that the number of generators of this group M sharp mod M is less than or equal to the rank of M. So if I could apply this remark directly over here, I would conclude that the number of generators of L perp sharp mod L perp had to be less than or equal to 22 minus K. But that number of generators has to equal the number of generators. So, by the way, for L, I can explicitly see, because it's diagonal, that L sharp mod L is exactly Z mod 2Z to the K. Right? I've just got a diagonal matrix, and I calculate this for each of those minus 2 classes. I get a Z mod 2. So the number of generators here is equal to K. So that suggests, and I'm going to put a question mark, that K is at most 11. So the very most naive remark predicted accurately that K is at most 19. This little computation suggests that K is at most 11, but many of you will have heard of what's called the Coomer surface, which is the one with the maximal number, and the maximal number is 16. So how did I get 11 when I'm supposed to get 16? And the answer has to do with this phrase torsion-free. So what would it mean for my lattice L that was generated by these 16 or these K disjoint rational curves? I have L mapping into lambda 319, and if there's torsion in the co-kernel, that means that there is some kind of linear combination, nj, cj, which is in lambda 319 with the nj's in the rationals but not the integers. Right? If you had a torsion class, then you would be able to divide the corresponding element by that that torsion element, and that division wouldn't happen inside L, it would happen inside lambda. So it's a similar thing to what I was doing when I put together n plus m perp and got lambda 319. I had to take possibly fractional combinations. So here I might have to take fractional combinations. And the only fractional combinations I have to worry about are really things of order 2. The denominators are really going to be order 2 because that's what the discriminant group is measuring, the things of order 2. So here's the question. If I'm given C1 up to CK, can I have subsets, or what can I say about the subsets of the set 1 to K, I in the set from 1 to K, such that 1 half times the sum for I in I, C little I, is in lambda 319. So here's where the modern analysis, which again is due to Nikulin, gets combinatorial in a quite pretty way. So let's think about such an expression and think about its self-intersection. So the self-intersection of this guy is half times minus 2 times the number of elements in I. And it's a self-intersection in an even lattice, so that better be an even integer. And so if that's going to be an even integer, that means that it's a quarter. Right? I squared a half. I forgot to square the half. And these are diagonal, so the only thing that contributes are the ci squared. Those are the minus 2s. So that implies that the number of elements in I is actually in 4z. But number of elements of I equal to 4 is not possible. And the reason it's not possible is that if you had such a guy, it would be a class of self-intersection minus 2 on the K3 surface. A class of self-intersection minus 2 on the K3 surface has to be effective. So I would have a situation where a half times C1 plus C2 plus C3 plus C4 is an effective divisor. And you can have that, but then each of the C's can't be irreducible anymore. This essentially leads to the D4 graph in some way, shape, or form. So you combine this with three of those, and you end up with a D4 graph. So I've sort of assumed that I didn't have the D4 graph. I just had isolated curves, so I don't have the possibility for number of I equal 4. You can have number of I equal 8. That's a very interesting case. Number of I equal 12 is slightly trickier to rule out. It can be ruled out. I'm not going to go through that part of the argument right now. Or I can have number of I equal 16. And I already know that I have at most 19 guys, so there really isn't any other multiple of 4 to try out. So the main thing that the combinatorics is involved with is cases where the number of curves is 8 or the number of curves is 16. And let me point out that if I were to add, so I've had my L sharp mod L was Z mod 2 to the plus K. If I now take this slightly larger lattice, L contained in M, where M mod L is Z2 to the L, then it turns out that M sharp mod M is Z2 to the plus K minus 2L. So every relation I put in, I drop the number of generators by 2L. And so eventually I get a K minus 2L less than or equal to 22 minus K. And so that tells me that K minus L is less than or equal to 11, or K is less than or equal to 11 plus L. So I'll be able to do to get past k equal 11 by making appropriate choices here. So for k up to 12, I can get away with a single collection of 8 elements. So if I have it, and again, 12 is not possible, but that's slightly trickier to rule out. If I have a collection of 8 elements, anywhere between 8 and 12, I actually have two choices for the structure of a K3 surface with 8, 9, 10, 11, or 12, 8, 9, 10, or 11 A1 singularities. Namely, 8 of them might have their sum divisible by 2 or not. Let me mention the geometry of having 8 curves divisible by 2. So let me resolve my 8 curves for a moment. So here are the 8 curves on the resolve guide, whose sum is divisible by 2. Now, there's a nice construction in algebraic geometry, a double cover construction, which you can perform anytime you have a line bundle which is divisible by 2 anytime you have a divisor, whose associated line bundle is divisible by 2 in the Picard group. So here I have the divisor, which is the union of all these curves, and by assumption, I've got a line bundle which is represented by half of the sum. So there is a double cover which is branched exactly in these curves. These are curves of self-intersection minus 2, and that double cover leaves you with curves of self-intersection minus 1. They can all be blown down to a y-bar, and y-bar turns out to be a non-singular K3. So this is the story of a non-singular K3 with an involution on it. An involution preserving the holomorphic 2 form, I upper star omega is omega, and I has exactly 8 fixed points. And when you take the quotient, you get a K3 again with 8 A1 singularities. So that's the geometry behind a collection of 8. So for K equal 1 through 11, I can have no extra class. That's possible. For k equal 8, let's see. Once I get to 13, I need L to be at least 2. So for k equals 8 to 12, I can have one extra class. And now you have to start playing some games for the higher ones. So for k equal 13, I better have L equal 2. For k equal 14, L equal 3. K equal 15, well, who knows exactly how far I can go with this story, but I'm telling you the answer. The top one is the Coomer one that I mentioned, where I have to go up to L equal 5. So I have to be able to find configurations of these points, and I'm not allowed to use 16 points. I'm ruling out 12 for reasons I'm not telling you. So I have to have ways of combining 2, 3, or 4 of these guys involving 13, 14, or 15 curves, and there turn out to be very clever ways of doing this. So I can have, this is 13 or 12, 12 or 13, it turns out. So I could have 3 sets of 4. And then the sum of this pair of sets of 4 and the sum of this pair of sets of 4 would give me 2 linearly independent 8 tuples, which could be divided by 2. So that's how you realize L equal 2. You need 12 curves. And if you have a 13th one, it comes along free, comes along for the ride. If I want L equal 3, I have to do... I have to do 7 pairs and I'm going to identify my 7 pairs with the points in P2 over F2. And now the way I'm going to get 4 tuples is I'll take a line in P2 over F2. That's a P1 over F2, which has 3 points. P2 over F2 has 7 points. And the complement of a line, these are pairs. Complement of a line is 4. So if I take 4 of the pairs, I can add those together. And the geometry of the set of all possible lines in characteristic 2, in sort of P2, tells me the combinatorics for this guy. So that's how I get this one. And then for 15 guys, I use P3F2. And then I use hyperplanes inside of P3F2. So that's 15 tuples minus 7 tuples. So the complement is 8 points. And the way I get my 15th guy is I allow in 16 things, let's see, I guess I do this same construction over the vector space, perhaps. Maybe I do it over F2 to the fourth. And I take affine lines in F2 to the fourth, and either it passes through the origin or doesn't pass through the origin, and I end up with 5 guys. So you run out of room to do the combinatorics just at the point that you run out of any possibility to embed the thing. There are lots of various arguments for why this is the maximum, but you end up with, in each of these cases, you end up with a K3, it's like a different Y, so maybe Y prime with an action of Z2 squared. Here you have a Y double prime with an action of Z2 cubed. Here you have a Y2 triple prime, a Y triple prime with an action of Z2 to the fourth. But those are that's the sort of maximal group you can have acting. And here you have a 4 torus. And it has an action it's really the quotient by the Z2 because the 16 does it, but then all of the 2 torsion points in the 4 torus end up giving you other elements of order 2 which act on the corresponding K3 surface. So that's how you end up with a quotient K3 that has a Z2 to the fourth action on it. Okay, so I promised you Kummer. This was Kummer from a rather lattice theoretic point of view. Next week I'm going to give the first talk about the relatively new construction of G2 manifolds. For that, I'm going to need to be able to take 2 K3 surfaces with the same underlying Ricci flat metric but different algebraic structures and match them together. And for that, I need various things about these lattices and how the Hodge theory fits together, which is why I've been doing the lectures on K3 first. So I'll start afresh next week, and I think I'm going to give 2 lectures next week and then December 1 maybe, whatever the Friday is, Friday after Thanksgiving. So I'll stop there. Any questions?
At one point you were talking about the random that the card group and then you erased it. What are the possibilities for the rank? Could you go over that again?
So in the algebraic case, the card group always has rank. Sorry, the rank is row, and the question is about the signature. So the signature in the algebraic case is always 1 comma row minus 1, but it might be indefinite, in which case it would be signature 0, row minus 1, 0, not indefinite. It might have a 0 eigenvalue. That's in the non-algebraic elliptic K3 case, and in the no elliptic or nothing case, it would be a negative definite lattice.
And do we need that at any point in these constructions?
So I didn't really state Nicolin's embedding theorems at all, but Nicolin's embedding theorems always depend on knowing what signature you have. So we'll need to know something about the signature when we apply them.
Okay.